Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present John Nichols, the Nation Magazine's national affairs correspondent, who assesses Donald Trump's apparent presidential election victory and what effective resistance to his extremist agenda could look like over the next 4 years. Jason Stanley, professor of philosophy at Yale University, and David Null, professor of law at Rutgers University, who talk about the threat posed to democracy by extremist MAGA state governments, which predate Donald Trump's entry into presidential politics. And Nora Benavides of the media democracy group Free Press, who discusses how social media platforms have degraded content moderation, creating an environment that has spread dangerous disinformation during the 2024 election campaign. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Two pregnant Texas women died from miscarriages after abortion care was denied them by doctors fearful of prosecution under the state's draconian abortion laws, where physicians face up to 99 years in prison for violating the statute. It took 3 emergency room visits and 20 hours before a hospital admitted 18-year-old Nevaeh Crane, too late to save her life. Joseli Barnica, a 28-year-old married mother, also suffering from a miscarriage, waited 40 hours for care until no fetal heartbeat could be detected. Both women died from sepsis, deaths that were preventable, according to more than a dozen medical experts who reviewed the records. ProPublica reports that after the U.S. Supreme Court declined to intervene, the restrictive Texas abortion ban and fetal personhood law supersedes the Federal Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act that requires hospitals to provide medically necessary care. The maternal mortality rate in Texas has skyrocketed 56% after the state's 2021 ban on abortion care far outpaced a slower rise in maternal mortality across the nation. Prominent extreme right-wing activist Ginni Thomas, wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, praised a religious rights group for fighting efforts to reform the nation's highest court, a campaign triggered in large part by her husband's ethical lapses. News reports in recent years have revealed that Justices Thomas and Samuel Alito failed to disclose accepting lavish gifts and vacations from prominent conservative political donors, some of whom have had business before the High Court. Ginni Thomas expressed her appreciation in a private email sent to Kelly Shackelford, an influential lawyer who leads the First Liberty Institute, a $25 million a year group that describes itself as defending religious liberty. Shackelford read Thomas's email aloud on a July 31st private call with his group's top donors. ProPublica reported that on the same call, Shackelford attacked Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan as treasonous and disloyal after she endorsed an enforcement mechanism for the court's newly adopted ethics code. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, nominated by President Biden, has also signaled her support for an enforceable Supreme Court ethics code. Public health officials across the U.S. are working to prevent the spread of a potentially dangerous combination of influenza strains as avian flu rips through one of the nation's largest milk-producing regions during the height of flu season. Epidemiologists have long warned that avian flu poses a significant pandemic threat to humans. As the number of infections among California's more than 17,000 dairy workers continues to grow. Politico reports that the timing of the avian flu outbreak raises the risk that the two viruses could mix, potentially creating a virulent mutation that could spread beyond dairy workers to the rest of the public. Unfortunately, some dairy farmers concerned about loss of profits have resisted cooperation with public health testing of their dairy cattle. Earlier episodes of human-to-human transmission of the avian flu led to widespread infections and thousands of deaths. The swine flu epidemic in 2009 combined swine flu, avian flu, and human flu genes that resulted in over 60 million people getting sick with over 12,000 deaths. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
As of production time early on Wednesday morning, November 6th, election returns from across the country indicated that twice-impeached former President Donald Trump and his vice presidential running mate, Ohio Senator J.D. Vance, have been elected to a four-year term. While the Republicans have retaken control of the U.S. Senate, it's uncertain which party will control the House of Representatives, a possible check on Trump's power, should the Democrats win control of that body. Trump comes into office with a radical right-wing agenda, detailed in the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025, that proposes that the entire federal bureaucracy, including independent agencies such as the Department of Justice and EPA, be placed under direct presidential control, with 50,000 federal civil servants to be fired and replaced by Trump loyalists. Trump has pledged to deport more than 11 million undocumented immigrants, eviscerate consumer and environmental regulations, and reverse policies to address the climate crisis. Trump says he'll veto any nationwide abortion ban favored by his Republican allies, but has indicated he's open to restrictions on contraception and the mailing of abortion medications. To many across the country, Donald Trump, who has praised Adolf Hitler and has repeatedly said he plans to prosecute or execute his political enemies, presents an existential threat to democracy. The next president, a convicted felon who attempted to violently overturn his 2020 election loss, is described by his former chief of staff as a fascist. Your reporter spoke with John Nichols, The Nation magazine's national affairs correspondent, who ponders the reasons why Trump won and what effective resistance to his extremist agenda could look like over the next 4 years.
You know, it's a bad night for the Democrats. How bad, we are going to find out. What was the problem? I think it's a multiple problem. First and foremost, they ran a campaign that basically neglected economics at a whole host of turns. This is an election year that is about economics. And the exit polls tell us this. There's a whole bunch of other factors that tell us this. You just didn't hear Kamala Harris or Tim Walz or, frankly, a lot of the Democrats talking as much as they needed to about raising the minimum wage, about the fact that when Trump was president, he restructured NAFTA and actually made it worse for workers, about the fact that, in general, there are a whole host of explanations why our economy is where it's at today, good and bad. They just didn't engage with that discussion at the level that they should have, and I think it harmed them tremendously. I think it also harmed them that they didn't sort out some sort of position as regards Gaza. And Gaza is a vital issue for a great many voters across the country, especially on campuses, in Arab American communities, but more broadly. I mean, I heard about this from rural organizers and rural activists in Wisconsin, where I live. This issue comes up a lot, and it was one where Kamala Harris needed to put distance between herself and Joe Biden. She made some minimal effort at that at the convention in August. But as the campaign went on, there really wasn't clarity there. And I think that did some harm. At core, I think the economic issues were the biggest area of weakness. I think Gaza, as I said, another area of weakness. And then, you know, we should not neglect the reality that in the United States, we have shown an inability as a country to wrap our heads around the idea of electing a woman as president. And I think that is not a factor that should be undiscussed. It is It's a reality and a painful one that we've got to wrestle with, because I believe America can elect a woman president, and I believe it's certainly time for that. But there's clear evidence of resistance, I think, and that's an issue we have to think about.
What is your message to people who are horrified by what might be coming the next 4 years, and what should they take heart in terms of the power of resistance?
Hey, look, here's the challenge. When Trump won the first time, I think there was a strong sense that he sort of dumb-lucked into it, right? That Hillary Clinton was, like her or not, a uniquely non-viable candidate with a lot of voters. And she ran a campaign that didn't connect in the ways that it needed to connect. And so everybody had excuses and explanations for that. This is different. Even though Biden held on for too long and the handoff to Harris was messy, ultimately, you know, it looked good on paper, but it didn't actually play out in a realistic way. You know, there's all these other factors that were in play. But the bottom line, I think, or the thing to kind of keep in mind here is Trump has won, and he has won as Trump. And you can like him or dislike him, but that's the fundamental reality. And so as a country, we've got to wrestle with that. And I think, you know, you can say, well, you're going to resist Trump, you're going to be in opposition to Trump. I understand that. But it's got to now be a somewhat different kind of opposition than in the first term. This has got to be an opposition that is rooted both in education and in criticism or and in opposition, right? It is clear that there are a lot of people who have not either don't want to, in some cases that's the case, or have not heard a credible alternative argument to Trumpism, right? And something that they would find more appealing, more viable for them. And so I think that there's absolute place for resistance. It's more necessary than ever. But it does have to be a different kind of resistance, a more sophisticated resistance, and one that does a lot of education, that says, you know, look, okay, you're concerned about these issues. Let's talk about them. Let's go deeper. Let's go deeper on the economics. Let's go deeper on foreign policy. Let's make those connections between, you know, a failed foreign policy, a misguided, a damaging foreign policy, and failures at home, right? All the economics and all the things that relate to that. And so it will begin in the states. Big march in Washington is not the answer. Maybe you may do it, it may be fun, but you have to work in the states. You're going to have to especially work in the states where you have, you know, some traction, something to work from, a Democratic governor, Democratic legislature, things of that nature. Then you're going to have to build it out nationally. We're going to have to see emergent leadership, people that are ready to speak about these issues and to stand up in very strong, very clear ways to Trump. I think it will be a new generation of leadership. You're going to still see Bernie Sanders, but you're also going to see people, I think, like AOC and others. These are people who can speak about Gaza, some of these other issues, in much clearer, much more useful ways. That's what I would say about where resistance stands.
That was John Nichols, The Nation magazine's national affairs correspondent and author. Find more analysis and commentary on Donald Trump's election victory by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Regardless of who sits in the White House, extremist MAGA politicians will continue to hold power in almost half the states in America. The movement that embraces both a libertarian hatred of government and white Christian nationalist theology has fueled the Republican Party culture war that's campaigned to outlaw abortion, invoke statewide book bans, censor the teaching of America's slave-era history, criminalize teachers who discuss LGBTQ issues in the classroom, and erased references to climate change from state law. Through voter suppression, gerrymandered state and federal legislative districts, and the incitement of political violence, right-wing activists elected to government office have imposed their extremist agenda that has marginalized and disenfranchised a majority of their state's multiracial population. While Donald Trump's incitement of the violent January 6 insurrection at the U.S. Capitol has come to symbolize the threat his movement poses to democracy, Republican governments, elected in many southern and midwestern states, have already implemented a long list of anti-democratic policies that are proposed in Project 2025's Authoritarian Blueprint. Your reporter spoke with Jason Stanley, professor of philosophy at Yale University, and David Knoll, professor of law at Rutgers University, who discussed the threat posed to democracy by extremist MAGA state governments. We hear first from Professor Knoll, who's co-author of Vigilante Nation, How State-Sponsored Terror Threatens Our Democracy, who responds to my question on how defenders of democracy can effectively respond to a Trump presidency. Professor Knoll, if Donald Trump wins the election, what is the best defense? What's the most effective approach defenders of democracy can take to push back, to resist the kind of imposition of Christian nationalist or fascist laws that will dictate what they do in their lives and erode freedom on a scale that we probably haven't seen in the history of our country?
John and I are, you know, sort of, we would consider ourselves nationalists. And sort of, we were raised thinking about the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. And so we look to Congress and we look to the federal government as a protector of civil rights. But sort of one thing that folks who are opposed to this movement can take from states like Texas and Tennessee is that the states are a real source of power, right? This all happened with Joe Biden in the White House, right? And there wasn't unified Republican control of Congress. And the states that are pushing these policies did so because they controlled state legislatures and they controlled the executive branch in states. And there's the response from other states, we go through this in detail in the book, has been pretty muted, right? There has not been a vigorous movement to counter these state policies from what we might think of as blue states. And so there's a double lesson there, right? You know, if Vice President Harris wins the election, then blue states are going to have a role to play in countering what red states are doing, because it takes a long time to enact federal policy, and then legislation, you know, doesn't emerge fully formed from Congress. So blue states need to do the work of prototyping policies that counter the spread of legalized vigilantism and what everyone, you know, is terming fascism these days. But that's going to be especially important if Trump wins again. And the broad lesson here is that when you have control of a site of institutional power, you have to use it. And right, blue state policy is a tool that has gone dramatically underused. So, you know, it can't just be attorneys general filing lawsuits trying to stop the most radical Trump policies when they come into effect. We have to be thinking systematically about how to push back against these anti-democratic moves that are coming out of red states. And if people get to the end of the book, we have a long list of 19 model laws that people can consider and blue state legislatures might consider taking up.
We hear next from Professor Stanley, whose latest book is titled Erasing History, How Fascists Rewrite the Past to Control the Future, who answers my question on defending democracy under an authoritarian Trump regime. If Trump is elected, what are the most effective ways to combat fascist repression?
Trump is a method to enable what's happened, the Christian nationalist agenda that we're seeing in states like Tennessee and in states in the South, states like Texas. He's a method to get that, to move that to the federal level. So what we've got to do is we've got to have state level resistance. In a sense, it's a kind of progressive federalism we've got to do. We've got to look at what Southern states did to essentially continue the kind of racial oppression and one-party states that have long held sway there in those states. We've got to look at what they've done to sort of keep injustice going, and we've got to probably adopt those strategies on the state level, with probably California, which is the closest thing to a multiracial democracy we have, leading the way on that. So the states are going to be much more important. And ironically, we're going to have to look at the strategies employed by places like Texas and South Carolina and Louisiana to stop the federal government from imposing civil rights law. We'll have to look at that and take lessons from it.
That was Jason Stanley, the Jacob Urwaski Professor of Philosophy at Yale University, and David Knoll, Professor of Law at Rutgers University. Learn more about the extremist right-wing state governments that are attacking America's democratic institutions by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Throughout the 2024 U.S. election campaign, there's been growing concern that the spread of disinformation by candidates, conspiracy theorists, and foreign actors could mislead voters into believing false narratives about the issues being debated and/or the veracity of the final vote count. The media democracy group Free Press has analyzed 12 major tech companies' readiness to address political disinformation and concluded that many of these social media platforms, including X, Meta, and YouTube, have either degraded or abandoned content moderation, creating an environment that has fueled the spread of dangerous disinformation before the November 5th election, a situation that is even more dangerous in the critical period after the election, when voters are focused on who won, who lost, and the integrity of the electoral process. Your reporter spoke with Nora Benavides, Senior Counsel and Director of Digital Justice and Civil Rights with Free Press, who assesses the danger posed by political disinformation in this election campaign and what social media platforms need to do to minimize the lies that can lead news consumers to distrust the electoral process and even incite political violence.
You know, I remember years ago when I started getting phone calls from people in my community. You know, they didn't have the word disinformation yet like we do now, and we certainly weren't using it all the time. But people would call me and they'd say, I feel like I've heard rumors that there are people, you know, cops in this community pulling people over. And at the time, we didn't even know how to fact check anything other than literally going to drive to the corner of where they were talking about to see if it was true. And we, over the years, have become more and more accustomed to hearing about this phrase, disinformation. And in the last several years, more and more efforts by other countries and even people here in the United States have purported to spread and create lies that make us believe, you know, false narratives. In particular, the way that social media, you know, is part of our everyday lives, there's really the disturbing reality that we all live with these different news feeds. Yours and mine might look really different, and the data that these companies collect about us gives those companies the ability to target us with specific content. So if you believe a certain, you know, set of beliefs, or you're part of different Facebook groups, Facebook could really target you with different content than me. And what we've been looking at over the last several years now is how that phenomenon, how these companies are applying policies and giving us content, how that whole world influences our beliefs. And what we've really found is that most of the largest social media companies, where people go almost every day for information, are not adequately prepared for this election. And certainly for the days that follow. Over the last year, we've witnessed that companies like Meta, you know, Facebook and Instagram and Threads, as well as YouTube and Twitter, which now everyone calls X, we've learned that they all have laid off staff. They have stopped applying policies around the big lie or claims that the election from 2020 was stolen. And we have found that increasingly they all promise that their AI and artificial technology programs can do the job that humans used to do. But we know that that's not the case. And we know actually that a lot of what we're seeing online right now is false. It's also in the gray area of maybe a little true and maybe very false. And then we also see things that are just conspiracies to make people afraid to really engage in democracy.
Well, Nora, we only have about 2 minutes left, but I wanted to ask you this question. And the question revolves around how to minimize the flow of disinformation and misinformation through social media platforms. It seems to be a matter of finding a reasonable balance between blatant censorship versus preventing irresponsible actions from metaphorically shouting fire in a crowded theater and causing a lot of damage and harm to people.
Yeah. You know, I think for the next few weeks at least, because that's what we're looking at right now, you know, when the election season and these types of lies are at their peak, we need social media companies to be doing their jobs. We need them to be applying their policies, the black and white letter that they have written and promised to apply for their own content. And we need them to be really committed to this issue where the online world and what people say online has offline consequence. So they should be applying their policies. In the days that follow, however, we know that given the track record of social media companies, it's unlikely that they're going to wake up literally tomorrow and start doing that. And so we need everyday people to also step in. And that's an unfortunate thing that we're telling people they have to do the labor. But we need to, all of us, set expectations about what's coming. And most likely our election results will not come on election night. So we have to be prepared for the lies. We have to be ready for old lies like the big lie and for new ones, you know, the immigrant lies and others. And then I would say we just need to find the ability and the grit to unplug, because over the next few days, we will have a deep desire for news, all of us, and very little as we're waiting for the results. So we'll be waiting and we'll be waiting, refreshing our news feeds. And those are the moments where we need to be very careful, since we'll be so vulnerable to disinformation. So take a beat and unplug, you know, go on a walk, and trust that so far our democratic systems have held.
That was Nora Benavides, Senior Counsel and Director of Digital Justice and Civil Rights with the media democracy group Free Press. Learn more about the work they're doing to curb the spread of disinformation and misinformation by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WUML in Lowell, Massachusetts, WDRT in Verwoca, Wisconsin, KFUG in Crescent City, California, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.